Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. It's been almost 3 years since Hurricane Katrina slammed into New Orleans. Residents who returned have been forced into tough financial decisions.
You just can't ask everybody to just wait indefinitely for the government to make up their mind what they're going to do or whether they're going to give you money or help you out. You just can't live like that.
And how do you live in a neighborhood that's still devoid of things we all take for granted?
You need school, you need post office, you need grocery store, you need gas station, you need, you know, all of those basic necessities of life that a neighborhood doesn't have, and there are many that do not have that.
We'll dedicate much of this week to the financial issues facing New Orleanians. But we're also going to money camp. Score!
How many of you want to be wealthy and financially free by the time you are adults?
Me. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. It ain't so easy living in the Big Easy these days. The financial challenges are enormous. 3 years on from Katrina, in some neighborhoods, there's not a single bank. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
In late July, I paid my first visit ever to New Orleans. I spent almost a week talking to residents who've returned because they can't imagine life without a little Creole spice. A recent report from the Greater New Orleans Community Data Center showed 70% of the pre-Katrina population is back in the city. But dig a little deeper, and you'll find not all are going back to their block. They've moved to higher ground. And 34% of residential addresses are still empty. For some perspective on what's keeping the rest of the population away, I spoke with Tina Marquardt of the nonprofit Beacon of Hope in the center's conference room. We were short distance from the shores of Lake Pontchartrain.
I am the only person back on my block, and we're almost at a three-year mark. The longer it takes for people to make decisions to return or overcome the roadblocks to return, it dissipates other people from returning also that may be able to, because they don't want to return to a neighborhood where there are no neighbors. So you've got the people that may not be able to return, and then you've got the people that can return but don't want to return to a desolate neighborhood.
What kinds of personal financial factors are people having to consider as they decide whether or not to come back?
Some of the financials are insurance. If you didn't have insurance coverage, I think it was, 2 years? Well, you were grandfathered in with your insurance company, so your insurance company could drop you, and they were looking at double the insurance coverage for homeowners policies. And then the cost of construction. You know, before the storm, I built a home that was around $110 a square foot. We're paying $150 to $160 a square foot. So if you take a person, for instance, the lady that has not rebuilt right next to my property, had a 2,500 square foot house. $150,000 is not going to rebuild the house that she once had. She's going to have to move into probably about a 1,100 square foot home. And so they have to decide, do I want to take the money and rebuild half the home that I had, or do I want to take that money and move elsewhere where I probably could get the size of the home with less construction costs and less homeowner's insurance?
What's behind that radical change in construction costs? Is it simply supply and demand? Are you competing with China?
I'm going to say material cost is up, but also the labor cost is up. My painter was telling me a quote he may have given someone right before the storm is nowhere near. I mean, if he was fixing to paint somebody's house before the storm and they came back and they're trying to rebuild and renovate, and he has to tell them up front, look, I cannot get anywhere close my labor costs. These guys are getting paid so much from other people to do jobs that I've got to increase the labor costs or I'll lose my workers.
Tina, what other considerations do people have as they decide either whether to come back or even to stick around? I've been driving around and, for example, I have a tough time finding a grocery store in these neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. I don't see any buses. I don't see public transportation. Very basic elements of living, particularly in a city, that are not here.
Yeah, I guess the first things that people look at is there a post office, which we do not have a post office yet in our neighborhood here in Lakeview. Grocery store, we just got the grocery store, Robert's, which is located below us on another floor, in January. We just got a Rite Aid, drugstore. We don't have a public school. Our public school is not rebuilt. So you need school, you need post office, you need grocery store, you need gas station, you need, you know, all of those basic necessities of life that a neighborhood doesn't have, and there are many that do not have that. So then you always have the chicken and the egg. You know, what's going to come back first? Is it going to be the residents or going to be the businesses? And thank goodness that the Lakeview businesses took a chance to reopen. We've seen that that has helped quite a bit.
A lot of what I've been hearing from people in terms of why 3 years out it's still such a struggle to get back is that the paperwork is nonstop.
Well, what we keep hearing is every time there's supposed to be a grant available or there's community block development money available, it's all available and it's there for you to request, but it's never came to fruition. It's never came down the pipe. It's anytime you meet with a lot of the, you know, redevelopment authorities, it's, well, we've been planning, but now we're implementing. Now we're in the implementation stage, but still there has been no money, even in our target zones. It's every time you go and you're fixing to hear about the money and the project start, and it's, well, within the next 30 days, we're going to release the plans back to the districts to one more time ask them, is this for sure what you want to see? And then within the 30 days, they'll be resubmitted back to us because we want the neighborhoods to be involved. And once they return those plans back to us, then we'll fund the project. But that's how it's been almost in every meeting for the last 3 or 4 months is that, yes, the money's been funded, so now we just need to review the plans again.
Would you agree that that's almost a full-time job as a resident?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because, you know, they're working and then they're also volunteering. Like in my little area, my neighborhood, we have meetings every Monday to discuss, okay, what's the problem in your neck of the woods or your block, and who is it city that we can contact about this? And right now we got storm drains that are clogged up because contractors are trying to cut their cost on construction. They won't get dumpsters. They're just throwing in the front of people's yards. And then when it rains, that debris gets washed down the road and it clogs up the storm drain. So I lost a foot of my new sod because my storm drains were clogged up on my street. So until I can get, you know, some more money, because anytime you reach the end of the project, you run out of fun. You know, you run out of your own personal money. And that's what a lot of people are up against when you see houses that may not have the paint finished on it or, you know, may not have landscaping or grass. They ran out of money because of the hiccups that would happen along the way.
Tina Marquardt is Director of Operations at Beacon of Hope in New Orleans. We'll have more Katrina anniversary stories later in the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
There is a bit of news we need to tackle before returning to New Orleans. Shares in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac suffered yet another meltdown this week. A report in Barron's said the company was low on capital and the government might step in to bail it out. If that happens, shareholders risk losing all their money. Even so, Marketplace's Rico Galliano discovered some of them are staying put.
For years, video producer Josh Cook has dreamed of doing the impossible, buying an apartment in New York City.
So to increase the capital for a down payment, I started investing in the stock market.
Last July, he bought into Fannie and Freddie. Their stock had just plunged and Josh thought it hit bottom. Guess what?
Since July, it's dropped about 50%, especially in the past couple of days.
Nevertheless, he's holding on to Fannie and Freddie shares. And so, by the way, is the manager of the equity index fund in my 401k, and maybe your fund manager, too. Why? I asked Charles Lieberman, chief investment officer at Advisors Capital Management.
We've held on to some of our positions on the basis that these stocks are so depressed that you can lose 100% of what's left, but typically those are small dollars, and the upside is very substantial.
Provided, that is, if the mortgage giants raise about $10 billion in new capital. They'd avoid a bailout, and their loans could keep generating cash. If the housing crisis lifts, the reward for holding the stock could outweigh the risks. As for new buyers, Lieberman recommends buying in only if you've got a very strong stomach. But he's looking seriously at the bonds the companies have issued to scare up all that capital.
Even if Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac were to be taken over by the government would back the bonds. They would not back the shareholders, but the bonds would be supported. You end up getting a higher interest rate than you would on a treasury, and you, at least conceptually, have government backing.
Of course, the interest rate is high because not all investors are convinced those bonds are a sure thing. And as Josh Cook discovered last July, when it comes to risky bets, you can't predict the future. He still hasn't got that apartment. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Time now for the audio op-ed that we call The Straight Story. And with me is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
How you doing, Tess?
Good, thanks. And as you know, we are this week marking the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. All kinds of housing and financial issues to talk about here. But, you know, I remember 3 years ago, there was a lot of talk about how this was a really good opportunity to address the issue of poverty in this country. Not seeing that.
Absolutely. You're not seeing it, but you're absolutely right. President Bush, you know, spoke about the problems of deep, persistent poverty and the legacy of racism. And just from the conversation you just had, not much has happened.
It's really quite shocking. And, you know, a big part of this is, you know, the American dream of owning your own home. And so many people are still struggling to simply find a place to live in New Orleans.
You know, that's part of the story. The other part of the story is at the time of Katrina, a group of scholars came out and they said, look, this is an historic opportunity. If we take advantage of this tragedy, and it is a true tragedy, and we help people move to better neighborhoods where the schools are better, there's less crime, it would be a stunning anti-poverty program. And it was lost. That opportunity was lost. We ended up with sort of the worst of both worlds, what you've been describing, and you know, we've had conversations off the air about what you saw. And elsewhere around the country, we haven't taken advantage of the situation to improve the lives of a lot of poor people.
Well, Chris, you know, as we talk about housing, a big contributor to poverty is and always has been the lack of affordable, decent housing. And I wonder if there might be some sort of silver lining in the current housing crisis as prices go down.
Absolutely. I think this is something that is being lost in all the understandable discussion about falling prices, homes going to foreclosure. So I'm not minimizing that tragedy at all. But, you know, affordable housing has been a real problem for the past 15, 20 years. And I think we have an opportunity to really go after the affordable housing issue. Right now, we have this severe decline in the housing market. It's sweeping up a lot of people. And my sense is that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that there are things that can be done to make housing more affordable.
All right. The Straight Story from our own Chris Farrell. Chris, we'll talk to you later in the show with some Getting Personal.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
When Hurricane Katrina hit the Crescent City, people knew there'd be tough financial choices. Now those who've rebuilt wonder if they made the right one.
We had three adult children living with us. We couldn't wait indefinitely. We couldn't live in a trailer. So we had to make a decision. We took a gamble.
We'll look at how those bets have paid off next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. And we're continuing our special coverage of the third anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. During my visit to New Orleans a few weeks ago, I found that one big financial decision that homeowners are still facing is how to rebuild in a flood zone. Casey King and his wife Kathy are still living in the 30-foot RV they bought 3 years ago. That's when Katrina chased them out of their 1,900-square-foot ranch house in the Gentilly neighborhood of New Orleans. Now the RV rests on the land where that house used to be, next to a sticks-and-sand outline of what they hope will be their new home. Their FEMA trailer sits nearby. The only thing that's just like it was before the storm is their backyard.
That's the London Avenue Canal levee wall.
You're living next to the canal.
Right.
The London Avenue Canal breached 400 feet from the King's home. Lake Pontchartrain poured into their neighborhood, destroying hundreds of properties.
So your house was fully underwater?
Yes, 9 feet for 15 days. So we decided to demolish, and we did that in June of 06.
Since June of 06, Casey, a retired Boeing engineer, has been trying to figure out a way to rebuild to a level of safety he's comfortable with. He's required by the city and by his insurance company to build above what's called base flood elevation. That level is marked on an oak tree beside his property.
That's the nail.
FEMA flood engineers spray painted it pink.
First livable floor has to be above this.
And how high is that here?
About 4 feet. And it says that's about sea level.
But you're planning to elevate far above this 4 foot level.
Yeah, my standard is the high water mark of Katrina, which is another 5 foot higher than that. So 9 feet.
9 feet off the ground. But he says he can't get any part of the project off the ground until he receives government funds to help pay for it. He's expecting up to $30,000 in elevation grants from the Louisiana Road Home Project. That's the state's main Katrina recovery program funded by the federal government. He's also expecting, possibly, another $30,000 in FEMA hazard mitigation grants. He says he can't, or he won't, start rebuilding without that money. The Kings aren't the only ones elevating their home, but if you look around the neighborhood, what you see is a patchwork of safety decisions.
Some of us are concerned and are elevating at different levels. Some are not elevating at all. Most are not elevating.
Well, let's take a ride.
Okay, good, good.
As we drove around Gentilly, the issue became clear. You have a house 9 feet up, next to a house rebuilt right on its old pre-Katrina foundation, and next to that.
Okay, now we come across our first modular house. This is 4 feet up, which is the minimum for the base flood elevation to qualify for any kind of flood insurance.
So if you're required to elevate in order to get flood insurance, how is it that so many people are allowed to rebuild at ground level? FEMA engineers came through and determined the extent of damage to each home after Katrina. If you had more than 50% damage, you were required to tear down your house, rebuild from scratch, and elevate. If you had less than 50%, you could just strip it down to the studs and renovate, which in most cases was vastly cheaper. It also meant that if your mortgage was already paid off, there was no one to require flood insurance. And the city was so desperate to get citizens back into the community, it allowed residents to appeal their damage assessments to get under the 50% cutoff. And that is how Jack and Dorothy Quarles got to rebuild on their old slab. Their house is just 2 doors down from the King's.
We live about maybe a block and a half from where the wall gave way on this canal. The wooden sections of the floor had floated up, and there was mold all through the house. The neighborhood looked like a war zone.
Jack says the family did consider raising the home several feet off the ground, but elevating can tack up to $90,000 onto the cost of rebuilding, depending on the size of the house. As we mentioned earlier, both the Louisiana Road Home Project and FEMA have grants available to help defray that cost. But most homeowners are still waiting for that money. And Dorothy Quarles says that's why their new house sits right where the old one did.
I couldn't wait 3 years like Casey. I mean, we had three adult children living with us. We couldn't wait indefinitely. We couldn't live in a trailer. So we had to make a decision. We took a gamble.
That gamble is that next time, if there is a next time, the levees will hold.
I don't have 100% confidence, and I pray about it, but, you know, I don't know. But to tell you this, if it floods again, you're going to have some people that are high up, but the other people aren't going to come back. They'll be nice and high and dry in their houses, but they won't have any neighbors.
And that's exactly the argument Casey King makes when he accuses government officials of failing to provide a vision for rebuilding New Orleans. He says the haphazard manner in which homes are going up in flood zones, including those built on the ground or at grade, could come back to haunt the city.
I think the number of renovated at grade houses is going to diminish the value of the neighborhood overall. People are going to come to this neighborhood and they're going to see high ones and low ones say, this doesn't look particularly safe.
Then let's ask that question. How safe is it here? Why are you building right here again next to the canal?
I believe that if I raise my house 9 feet, that I can evacuate, leave everything in the house, and it'll be here when I come back.
Purely as a financial consideration, but it's got to cost more now to live here.
Yes, and this is why these incentives are so essential.
Financial incentives that are taking the long road to get to homeowners. In a moment, paperwork, delays, and the priority of fraud prevention. Shirley Laska directs the Center for Hazards Assessment Response at the University of New Orleans. She's what you might call an elevation specialist. And she's worried that so many people are deciding to build right back on the ground where their homes were submerged after Katrina.
The delays have been really the death knell of a very successful elevation process. You have to elevate your house before you can repair it. And by delaying it for 2.5 to 3 years, and then some of the money will be delayed even longer than that, you're asking people to just, you know, make ends meet until they can afford to get that house elevated in. It really is asking too much.
It was certainly asking too much of Jack and Dorothy Quarles.
You just can't ask everybody to just wait indefinitely for the government to make up their mind what they're going to do or whether they're going to give you money or help you out. You just can't live like that.
People are having to make tough decisions.
Paul Rainwater is the executive director of the Louisiana Recovery Authority, which runs the Road Home program.
And so what we're trying to do is put the financing piece of this together. But it is frustrating. It's frustrating for everyone. I mean, but it is an opportunity to move forward.
Rainwater took over the authority about 8 months ago after being appointed by the new governor, Bobby Jindal. Rainwater says he understands how 3 years later, homeowners wonder why they're still waiting for FEMA and Road Home money.
Now, look, I'm not making an excuse for the bureaucracy. I didn't design the program. I took over the program, and what we're trying to do is lean it out as best we can and streamline it and push things forward. I mean, my goal is I have a contract that ends June of 2009, and our goal is to get money out to people as quickly as possible.
The Road Home Elevation Program has $1.2 billion to hand out. As of mid-August this year, officials say they've disbursed $139 million of that. But even if you're approved for a grant, it doesn't mean the money's in your bank account.
Welcome back to Road Avenue Rouge.
Hi.
First
of
all, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Mary.
Bert and Mary Swafford's pre-Katrina home was swamped by the levee break at the 17th Street Canal, 6 miles away. In July of this year, they moved into their new mid-city home, 9 feet off the ground.
We call the house Bateau Rouge because it's this big red boat that's sailing above everything else.
Mary says there was no real debate about whether they would elevate the new house.
We could have tried to fix our old home, but the financial burden of repairing the existing structure was far more than starting anew.
The Swaffords applied for a $30,000 Road Home Elevation Grant in September of 2006. They were approved in February of 2007. Mary has a 4-inch stack of paperwork to show for her efforts, but they have yet to see a dime of that money. They got an SBA loan to build the house anyway, and they're the only homeowners on their block to elevate.
My immediate thoughts to that are, oh my God, how can you not raise your home? But then when I really think about everyone's situation here in New Orleans, it's expensive. The cost of building the foundation and the piers up 9 feet was almost $40,000. That was with nothing sitting on top of the piers.
I feel some people may just have gotten frustrated with all the paperwork and all of the constant, you need this form, oh wait, no, that you need to talk to another person. And after 4 or 5 months of that, they just gave up.
Some of this is about accountability and the fact that Congress gave us this money.
Road Home Executive Director Paul Rainwater.
And so there are a lot of pieces to this to make sure that, you know, people are, they actually own the home and that they are meeting the base flood elevation. And
but do you think a 4-inch thick stack of papers is a little much?
Well, it depends. If you're the federal government, you want to see accountability at the end of this day.
To date, the Road Home program has found 42 instances of suspected fraud. Back in Gentilly, Casey King repeats his accusation that community leaders have no real vision for post-Katrina New Orleans. And he's worried that people who rebuild on the ground are basically giving up.
Here's what I hear people say in the neighborhood. Next time it happens, New Orleans won't be. We're the hell of beans, and I'm out of here. That is not what I would call long-term commitment to the community.
We have a narrated slideshow of the Kings, the Quarles, and the Swaffords at marketplace.org. In a moment, we'll get advice from Katrina survivors on preparing for the next disaster.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
One of the ways people exorcise the demons of catastrophe is to write about them. I tried counting the number of Hurricane Katrina-related books listed on Amazon. I stopped after I hit 100. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet one of the latest entrants in Katrina storytelling. I found him hunched over a beer at a neighborhood bar in New Orleans mid-city.
My name is Ian McNulty. I'm a freelance writer here in New Orleans. I'm also the author of a recently published book, Season of Night, New Orleans Life After Katrina. Well, we're in Finn McCool's Irish Pub in Mid-City, which is the neighborhood right in the heart of New Orleans. I moved back in October of 2005, and I started writing my book at home, working on the second floor of my house because the first floor was gutted and flooded. Well, Finn McCool's reopened on St. Patrick's Day, 2006, after being completely rebuilt. And I decided, hey, if they were going to open my neighborhood, I was going to come here. And I quickly moved my my after-hours writing office to their Cypress Bar. Jobs pay vastly different rates. You know, sometimes I get a dollar a word for stories. Sometimes I get 15 cents a word. Last year, I think I made $70,000. Doesn't include the book yet. It was more than I was making with a day job. And here's a passage from the book. The longer I stayed in Baton Rouge, the heavier the question of home and its fate weighed on me. The only thing that helped was actually going back home on weekend trips, seeing the old house, and being on familiar streets. You know, looking back on the time, I was writing this book for myself because I thought, you know, this is happening, I can't believe it, I need to write this down. It's sort of a cathartic effect of writing. The thing about Katrina that makes it different from all these, a lot of other disasters, because of the levee failures and the flood and the way that it lingered, everybody had to leave. So this entire city, 1.5 million people, were gone. Well, the book came together, so I started out, you know, peddling it to literary agents, and the message that I got from them was, there's too many Katrina books in the pipeline already. Sorry, kid, you're too late, that kind of thing. So I decided that I would try to circumvent the whole book proposal process by putting all of the elements that normally go into a book proposal, which is about 20 pounds of paper with your cover letter, your bio, your marketing plan. I decided I would put all of that online. So I made a very simple Fisher-Price style website that had all of those traditional elements of a book proposal just on it as links. So with that website, I was able to send around individual emails to each one with a simple message. You're busy, so am I. I won't waste your time. I have a book about Katrina. It's different. Click this link below and you'll find everything you need. I didn't hear back from most of those people. Eventually, one publishing company did, and went with it. The first question I get when people find out I wrote a book about Katrina is, well, how is it different from all these other books that we see at the bookstore? And really, what those first wave of books were doing was describing the kind of screaming crisis of the disaster and surviving in its immediate aftermath. All I really wanted to do was move back home to Mid-City and resume my life again in New Orleans. It wasn't an easy time, but there was also that joy of homecoming, seeing people and places again that for at least a little bit you thought maybe were gone forever.
We've got a link to Ian McNulty's book and website at marketplace.org. And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So how do you prepare your finances for an emergency? Well, I asked some of the folks I talked to in New Orleans what they learned and what advice they have for you.
Pre-Katrina, I thought I was very organized and prepared. And I sort of dropped the ball evacuating for Katrina because we were first-time homeowners. I didn't bring my closing paperwork or the title to the house, any of that information, which was then destroyed.
And I'll tell you what happened to me. My bank, there was a lady who worked in the safety deposit area. And I just happened to ask her one day, about a year before Katrina hit, what would happen if this whole area flooded? Would my documents be safe? And she says, well, not exactly.
You know how people take a lot of photos of family events and stuff like that? Well, they were in my closet. I couldn't take all those pictures with me, and they all got ruined.
You know, when this happens, you have no access to your bank account, even if you've got one. So you're out of town, you know, in my case, my boss was desperately trying to mail me my paycheck, and I thought, well, what am I going to do with it when I get it?
Credit cards weren't working, and, well, nobody would take a check, so I definitely would take cash, whatever amount of cash you can get a hold of.
I keep $200 in cash ready to go. I don't touch it, and I run with it if I have to.
So I would say have a plan for your documents.
Now I keep all of them in plastic bins. In case there's a hurricane that comes suddenly, I have it in a plastic bin in a high place, because if the roof falls in, I don't want those things to get wet.
I have plastic file boxes, which actually has turned out to be a great thing, because if I have to run and run quickly, I can just pick up the boxes and go.
One of the things that I'm doing is, instead of having file cabinets, I have plastic bins, so I can just grab my bins and stick them in the car.
I scan, or I have scanned, all of my important documents onto my computer. Also, I know this exists somewhere, I just haven't found it yet. A database where I can upload all of my important documentation so that it's somewhere else. You know, in case something happens in the 5 minutes I'm away from my house.
Those are the voices of Katrina survivors Allison Plyer, Harry Hoskins, Mary Swofford, and Jack and Dorothy Quarles. And later, some personal thoughts on what it means to see post-Katrina New Orleans. You only get one first job. Commentator Robert Reich began at an ad agency, and he soon realized he was not there to write brilliant copy.
The head of the firm gave me a different assignment. It was to take care of his dog, which he brought into the office every day. A big Irish wolfhound named Prince, who had a bowel problem.
Living proof that Plan A does not predict future success. Coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. I am so sorry to bring this up, but school's about to start. For kids, it's time to break out the backpacks and three-ring binders. All that's left of summer camp are memories of bunk beds, bug juice, and balance sheets. That's right, campers. Not all of you spent your summers canoeing. Some used their time to become mini masters of the universe. We sent Caitlin Carroll off to money camp with sunscreen and a microphone.
I walk into the second day of Camp Millionaire expecting to find a bunch of Alex P. Keatons. Remember him from the 80s sitcom Family Ties?
Normal childhood. I did the things that all kids do, like the color, like to finger paint, play the stock market.
Instead of three-piece suits and briefcases, I find about 30 fidgeting high school students in T-shirts and jeans. They're taking a weekend out of summer vacation to learn about stock portfolios and compound and simple interest.
How many of you want to be wealthy and financially free by the time you are adults?
Camp Millionaire is one of many camps cropping up across the country that introduces kids to finance. Camper Tracy Liu says before this weekend, she never gave her spending a second thought.
Honestly, I did not know how to keep my money. I just like TOEFL play, shopping, everything. But, you know, once you actually learn, you think about the money a little more.
Liu stands near a set of big bottles filled with moolah. Moolah is the fake cash kids earn by doing things like identifying what dividends are or what it means to be highly leveraged.
In the jars over there is living, financial freedom, saving, education, play, and donation. And we have set up in percentages, so then you know how much you would put in with each category for the near future.
I work for a business show, so I should know this stuff, right? Elizabeth Donati says it's okay, lots of people don't. That's why she started Creative Wealth International, the company that runs Camp Millionaire. Donati coaches the kids on what she calls the three pillars of wealth: real estate, business, and stocks.
And all of a sudden, the light bulb goes off, and they think, oh, it's this investing that makes me financially free, not working for a living. And that's what we want them to get.
Camp Millionaire's lessons are pretty simple. They're a combination of do-it-yourself investments and basic budgeting. Simple or not, Penn State University professor Kathy Bowen says most kids don't learn them from family or in a classroom.
You know, it's kind of strange that we can be taught a lot of things so that we can earn a living, but it seems strange that we're never really taught how to manage our money in a formal setting.
Parents of these budding Warren Buffetts pay $200 each for the weekend seminar. There's also a variety of books and websites that teach kids about finance. USC sociologist Karen Sternheimer says most families need help starting conversations about money.
We sometimes, as adults, buy things because we think they make us better people, or we, you know, erroneously think they're going to totally make us happy. And we don't like to see that in ourselves, and I think that's what makes it really difficult to talk about with kids.
Sternheimer says it's never too early to start the conversation. By the time kids finish college, one in five will owe $5,000 on credit cards and at least $10,000 in loans.
So the idea that we've been trying to keep kids separate from money, that's a construction that is based in the way that we like to think about kids. It's not necessarily based on what's, quote, best for kids.
Back at camp, students are coming up with answers for a fill-in-the-blank word game, like...
Yeah, and assets feed you, liabilities eat you.
Parent Sherry Fan says the camp's made an impression on her daughter.
She said, Mommy, they keep saying what's financial freedom. I said, to me, financial freedom is if you go out to a restaurant, you can order whatever you want, and it's not affecting your bank balance.
Camp Millionaire definitely puts the emphasis on freedom. Campers plan their own businesses and create dream boards for the future.
Hey, yourself!
The millionaires in training are now busy crunching numbers on how much it will cost to rent an apartment. One group of guys is already trimming expenses to balance their budget.
We cut out cars, bikes, eating out.
No haircuts, no TV. Sounds pretty Spartan. One boy says it'll be tough to live without a car, but he's willing to make the sacrifice if it guarantees him in later life the one thing he prizes most as a teenager: independence. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace Money.
All these kids with delusions of becoming the next Warren Buffett, they may not realize it, but most of them are in for a rude awakening. Before they score a corner office with floor-to-ceiling glass windows, they might have to brave a windowless room, like maybe the basement. Just ask commentator Robert Reich. He tells us that his first work experience went to the dogs.
My first job was as an ad man. Well, that's something of an exaggeration. It was a job in an advertising agency that today we'd call an internship, a kind of foot in the door that might someday lead to a real job. Well, in truth, it wasn't even a foot in the door, more like a big toe. I was a gopher, someone who's told to go for coffee, go for sandwiches, go for this or that package. I gophered for weeks, running around New York City on errands. But even though being a gopher wasn't glamorous, I was fired with enthusiasm. I basked in the glow of the firm's worldly wise creativity, its brand name clients, and the important meetings I'd supply with coffee, sandwiches, and packages. After a time, I got fewer gopher assignments. Now, I assumed this meant I was now primed for the big leagues, ready to join a full-fledged ad campaign. But the real reason was I didn't know New York well enough and got lost when I went for a package more than a few blocks away. I was so late with one of them, I didn't deliver it in time for an important meeting. So they stopped asking me to gopher. At this point, the head of the firm gave me a different assignment, but it wasn't an ad campaign. It was to take care of his dog, which he brought into the office every day, a big Irish wolfhound named Prince, who had a bowel problem. My job was, well, you can imagine. I told myself this was a kind of promotion. After all, I was now working for the boss, but I was actually working for Prince. And one day, I was scraping Prince's bowel problem off the small terrace outside the boss's office for the third time that day, in the 95-degree heat and humidity of a New York August, and I finally realized something I should have known all along. This job wasn't going anywhere. So I summoned the nerve to tell the boss I wouldn't take care of Prince anymore, and he summoned the indignation to tell me I had a nerve. And that was that. I ended my first job just as I had started it. Fired with enthusiasm.
Robert Rice teaches public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Anybody else wondering what that boss is doing now? Safe bet he isn't a former cabinet secretary.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
All right, it's time for Getting Personal when we turn the microphone around to answer all of your personal finance questions. And with me, once again, is our own personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. And Chris, we're going to talk to Leif in Belgrade, Montana. And he's got a situation that started with some tumbleweeds and a spark on a piece of vacant land next to his home. Somehow, it's gotten to the point that a lien might be placed on his property. Leif, tell us what happened.
Sure. About this time last summer, the power line sparked right outside our property and started a pile of tumbleweed that's on land that's the property owners association's responsibility off fire, and that lit their fence afire, and it spread down our property line, and we got it put out, and everything seemed great, and the property owners association came out and looked at it, and they decided they were going to rebuild it. You know, everything went great, and a few months later, we got a bill from them. We were kind of surprised by that.
Uh-oh. How much?
Not a whole lot. It's $650, but kind of it's not my fault, man, factor. The root of my question to you guys is, how adversely would it affect our credit score if we allowed them to place the lien on our property?
Chris, is that something that would affect your credit score?
It possibly could affect your credit score. Part of it depends, does a data broker pick it up? Does it actually show up in your credit report? It could ding your credit score a little bit, but if they file the lien on you and you have a lawyer and then you get rid of the situation and then you put that on your credit report, it should probably dissipate fairly well. So the way that I'd look at it is somewhat like, what would be a good analogy? You know, like missing a credit card payment. It's not going to be dramatic. It shouldn't be dramatic like a tax lien would be. But there's a possibility, if it does get picked up by a data broker, that it might have an impact.
But it's impossible to say how much of an impact?
Yeah, it's because there's so many other things that go into the credit score. So this would just be one factor. But if I were going to be buying a home or selling a home, like selling your place right away, then I wouldn't get involved with a lien.
Chris, any thoughts on withholding the $650?
Well, it sounds like, you know, sort of that mixed thing. You know, do you pay the money because you just want to get rid of the headache and you don't want to deal with a lien and you just don't want to deal with any of this? But you know, there's a part of me that says, well, I'd rather pay a lawyer than pay the homeowners association if you're in the right.
So, Leif, if the credit score really isn't going to be a huge deal, as Chris seems to think it wouldn't be, what do you think you'll do?
I'm still trying to decide. I'm going to go to the owners meeting tonight and see if I can't convince them to come to a different agreement.
All right. Well, let us know what you decide to do and how that turns out.
I will.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, if you are looking to put out the wildfires in your financial life, let us help. We'll try to provide you with a little bit of water and a hose. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, Chris, let's go to an email. And Amanda writes in from Indianapolis. She's got about $5,000 that she and her husband want to invest in a renewable energy company. This is a common question that we're getting, how to do this. The companies that she's most interested in, though, are in Canada and England. So that means foreign investments. And she found some brokers who do overseas investing online, but they've got a minimum of $10,000 for an investment. Again, they've only got five here. So she wants to know if there's a broker who could help her with just a $5,000 investment, or if this is all just too complicated and maybe she should put that money into a U.S. company.
I would take a different route, Tess. The main route that I go is find a mutual fund or an exchange-traded fund, an ETF, that invests in alternative energy globally, around the world. Because it's going to be very expensive to buy individual stocks overseas. Secondly, buying individual stocks is risky anyway. And it seems to me we're talking novice investors. And not only are you looking at individual companies, but you're looking at individual companies overseas.
And aren't there all kinds of tax implications that way as well?
Right. So let's go the mutual fund route or the exchange-traded fund route. Make it easy. If you really, really, really want to buy individual companies that are overseas, there is a very easy way to buy it here in the United States, and they're called ADRs, American Depository Receipts. ADRs tend to be bigger companies. But again, it's a very cheap, easy way. If you go to all the sort of like, E-Trade and that type of thing. But my main one is mutual funds, exchange-traded funds. Yes, go ahead, invest in alternative energy if that's important for you. But even though we're going for one sector of the market, let's get some diversification. And I think it's smart to invest globally.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for questions today. But we are answering your personal finance questions online every weekday at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there. Thanks as always, Chris, for the great advice.
Thanks.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Some final thoughts on the Big Easy 3 years post-Katrina. There are lots of firsts for new visitors to New Orleans, like me. The first nighttime ramble down Bourbon Street, the first tastes of gumbo and beignets, the first blast of hot, wet Louisiana air. And today, if you venture out of the tourist zone, there's your first hieroglyph. That big X with coded numbers that rescue teams used to indicate when the house was searched and how many bodies were found. It's a scar that still marks tens of thousands of homes across New Orleans. I saw my first as I was driving north on Elysian Fields Avenue, probably a mile and a half or so from the French Quarter. It was a bright pink house with turquoise blue trim. The front doors and windows were boarded up. A red hieroglyph showed it was inspected on September 11th, 2005, 13 days after Katrina. I kept driving past another and then another, house after house, still boarded up, still marked up. It shocks the conscience to think that it's been 3 whole years since Katrina, and on this main drag, it looks like it's been maybe a month or two. As I kept driving toward Lake Pontchartrain, I started to cry. Over the next several days, I walked and talked with a dozen New Orleanians trying to repopulate the neighborhoods like Gentilly, Mid-City, Lakeview, the Lower Ninth Ward. I asked them how they drive through the city, day in and day out, without crying. "Booze and pills," said Casey King. He was only half joking. And then he said, "I guess you get used to it." I guess the rest of us have gotten used to it, too. We've read and heard so much about how NOLA was back up and running, and the French Quarter, downtown, almost like nothing happened. So what I expected, what I envisioned, was recovery. What recovery? Today, we're 1 year shy of the amount of time it took to rebuild Europe after World War II, and there is nothing resembling a Marshall Plan underway in New Orleans. I've been trying to figure out for the last few weeks why I'm so profoundly upset by that. I have no personal stake in New Orleans. I don't have family there. I don't have friends there. Or I should say, I didn't. And I remember back 3 years ago when there were questions about whether to even rebuild the city. I wasn't sure what the answer should be. But that's when all I really knew of the disaster was through the hundreds of articles I'd read and the hours and hours of coverage I'd watched on CNN. It's different to walk on that ground that became a lake floor for 2 weeks, ground that now boasts cracked sidewalks, potholes, and slab foundations engulfed by 4-foot-tall weeds. Each evening after spending the day out in the neighborhoods, struggling to survive, I'd return to the French Quarter to get a taste of the old New Orleans. One night I stopped in for a Sazerac at the famous Carousel Bar, and I struck up a chat with my stoolmates. It was a young couple visiting for the weekend from northern Louisiana. I was sharing some of these same observations with them when the husband looked at me and said, "They chose." They chose not to have the proper insurance, he explained. They chose to live in a bowl. It is so vastly more complicated than that. But there's the sentiment, even from a fellow Louisianan. It goes a long way toward explaining why, 3 years later, we have collectively abandoned New Orleans, and why those who chose to return remain pioneers in their own city. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to check out our narrated slideshow from New Orleans at marketplace.org. We've also got links to the latest research on the Big Easy's recovery effort. Next time, a couple that works together stays together?
For the first couple of years, yeah, we arm wrestled a number of different things. And, you know, and I think eventually you just kind of have to come to the realization, you know, compromise is best.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. American Public Media.